Tom Weber here on NPR News. We're now going to look at the fate of bees and butterflies and other pollinators in Minnesota and across the country and the world. The White House just last week released the final version of a plan that had been announced last year to improve pollinator health. The report also confirmed data that show mortality rates remain too high for honeybees. And while monarch butterfly migration improved last winter, it does remain tenuous for that population as well. And there was a major global assessment of pollinators by a UN-affiliated group earlier this year that found about 40% of invertebrate pollinator species, invertebrates like bees and butterflies, face extinction. Three scientists from the University of Minnesota now join me to discuss this and to take your questions. Marla Spivak is also here from the U at the Department of Entomology. A few years ago, won a MacArthur Genius Grant for all her work on bees. Marla, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I'm glad you're here. Dan Caravo is an assistant professor in the Department of Entomology as well. Still in your first year, is that right, Dan?
That's true, yep.
Having moved here from Jersey.
Yeah, exactly. It's great to be here.
I'm glad you're here. And Karen Oberhauser is a professor in the U.S. Department of Fisheries, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having us.
I'm glad you're here. Your questions for our guests here today, for you backyard beehive keepers or monarch butterfly cultivators, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, online at nprnews.org/live, and please don't call or text if you're driving. Marla, I'm going to start with you because a few years ago when you won that grant, this was a big thing, right? The headlines were all there about the honeybees are dying and things like that. And with any news story, the attention and the spotlight ebbs and flows. And so I'm just curious to get your update on we're 2 years later from when this was the big story the first time. How are things going? Has it improved at all?
The situation for honeybees has really not improved. Of course, there's better years and worse years, but overall, honeybee losses are unsustainable, and they're at 30 to 40% annually. So we lose 30 to 40% of all of our honeybee colonies yearly, which puts a lot of stress and onus on beekeepers to replace those losses because we need a certain number of colonies just to satisfy pollination contracts across the U.S.
And Karen, what about the headlines of the monarch butterflies, right? The attention ebbs and flows. So what's the update there?
Well, just like the bees, monarchs aren't doing very well right now either. And I think one thing about monarchs is they're this flagship species. So we really don't get a lot of ebbing and flowing. We just maintain strong interest in monarchs. So I think people's attention to monarchs is going to help all the workhorses of the pollinator world out there, the bees, the honeybees, and the native bees.
I mean, are we closer to answers, though? Are we closer to why this is happening?
I think so. There has been a lot of attention, and starting with President Obama's memorandum on pollinator and monarch conservation, that we've really put a lot of minds to work answering these questions. We know that it's not just one thing that's happening. There are lots and lots of causes for these declines, but we know that a big one is habitat loss. So we're actually setting goals. How much habitat do we need? How many milkweed plants do we need to get out there on the landscape? How do we need to put that out? What's the spatial distribution of what we need? So we really are working on that. And then in the end, it's just going to take people agreeing to put habitat into the land that they have control over.
And Dan, you study something I think is frankly, before I interviewed you, I never put it together that it exists because you hear so much about honeybees and then you forget that there are other bees that are even more native and even wild here in Minnesota. And I don't know, maybe they don't get as much attention either, but are they in collapse? Are they in a dire situation?
Well, when we heard from Marla and Karen, there are the monarchs and the honeybees. But when we talk about native bees, there's at least 20,000 species of bees on Earth. So it's,
to give you not just the honeybees.
It's not just the honeybee. They're a really great, important species, but they're one of 20,000. To give you a perspective, there are 10,000 birds on Earth, and 20,000 is a low estimate. People are really just still discovering new species of bees all the time. So when I get asked about how are the bees doing, it's kind of a question of which ones are you talking about?
Which are the 20,000?
Which are the 20,000? Yeah. So we don't know how many we have here in Minnesota. We think there's some work in Wisconsin has showed about 400 or so species of bees, so probably something similar to that. And some of those species we know have really declined quite a bit. There's one in particular, a bumblebee called the rusty patch bumblebee, that used to be quite common here in Minnesota and throughout the East. And it's really difficult to find. It's not extinct. It's still around, but it's almost gone. Some species, like the common eastern bumblebee, is really common. You can find it anywhere here in the middle of the Twin Cities. So some species we know are really going down, and some species seem to be doing okay. But what we really lack on these bees is data. We don't have a good idea of how these bees are doing. So we're just really trying to get a lot more information on these species.
So in general, if you're out and you see a bumblebee on a plant, it's probably...
It's probably the common eastern bumblebee. Yep.
This is so interesting. One of the reasons you came here, and we're going to talk about the bee building that's opening up here soon with all the research going on. But one of the reasons I understand you came here is because this is so crazy to me that we don't know the answer. How many bee species are in Minnesota? We don't know the answer.
We don't know the answer to that. And that's a big collaborative project. So people like Crystal Boyd at the Department of Natural Resources and in my lab and other people are really starting to collect a lot of bees and to try to get the number of those species that are out there. So to do that work, we really have to get out with nets out on the ground and just collect a ton of bees and then get a bunch of taxonomists who know who can identify these bees. It's very difficult to do this identification work. And that it's a really long process, but we're starting to build up those databases and trying to see what those are. And we're going to be discovering new species. I think this list will be kind of a work in progress for years and years and years.
Is it safe to say, Marla, that in the last few years, right, when these stories first started hitting a couple years ago, and this just became a really big attention getter, have we spent the last few years... and I don't mean this disparagingly. Have we only been able to spend the last few years figuring out the problem, or have we been able to actually help solve the problem as well?
I would say both. It's taken quite a while to understand the complexity of the problem because there's so many factors happening at once with the habitat loss. Of course, there's some pesticide issues, and then bees have their own diseases and parasites, and understanding what they are and how they impact not only honeybees, but native bees and also monarchs. But people are really understanding that key to helping all of the bees and monarchs is getting more flowers in the ground. And the presidential memorandum shows that very clearly. The questions we have to remain are exactly what Karen brought up. How many flowers do we plant? Where do we plant them? But I think for now, the public... Everybody's interested in this solution, which is a quite nice one, to put flowers in the landscape.
Well, you know, you're talking about this White House memorandum, and I'm not going to, I don't mean to be disparaging. It probably didn't get the biggest headline even last week. There were a couple other things going on in the world last week, like Brexit. And so the White House released this final report, and there are these three goals, these three main goals that we're focusing on. And I think the sense here is to create a national dialogue of let's focus on these three. And one of them is reduce honeybee overwintering colony losses, to what you're talking about, Marla. Reduce those losses to no more than 15% within 10 years. Hey, that's a great goal.
Yes, it is.
Let's put it up on the wall. How in the heck do you do it?
That's going to be hard. So a lot of research needs to go into alternative ways to control a parasite that affects all honeybee colonies. It's a mite, and it sucks on the bee's blood, and it's very, very difficult to manage. So we need ways to reduce the number of this mite, the levels of mites in colonies. These mites are kind of like mosquitoes in that they vector viruses that then are deadly to the bees. So one area of very active research that has to become more creative and novel is ways to manage that mite without applying chemicals inside the bee colony. And then the other way is just to provide bees with better nutrition.
Karen, the other next bullet point on those three goals is to increase the eastern population of monarch butterfly to 225 million which is also visualized in saying that that would occupy 15 acres of the overwintering grounds in Mexico. These are migrating animals, so Mexico has a role to play here too. Great, great goal. Let's put it up on the wall. How do you do it?
Right. So that's been very exciting to work on that. I was involved in a group that got together and said, what is a viable population for monarchs? And basically what we did is we looked at the amount of variation that we see in the population from year to year. And we had high numbers in Mexico this winter, but then just before they left Mexico, there was a big storm that wiped out a large percentage of the population. So we have these unpredictable, uncontrollable events. And luckily, we started at a pretty high number, so losing a big proportion didn't completely wipe out the population. But I'm sure many of your listeners are noticing that they're seeing very few monarchs. So what we estimated is we need to get back to a population that's well over 200 million monarchs. And what we did is we calculated how many milkweed plants we needed to plant in order to get back to that many monarchs. And we're looking at where we need to put them on the landscape. So we have a goal. The presidential memorandum has a goal that's based on good, solid science. And now we need to get people involved. And it's just like the bees need. Monarchs need flowers. Monarchs need milkweed. So we just need the engagement of the public to get this happening.
And Dan, the third one on this list of three goals is to restore or enhance 7 million acres of land for pollinators over the next 5 years. Hey, good goal. Put it up on the wall. How do you do that?
That's a goal I think we can achieve. And we're really, as you know, all around the country, I think this is more and more habitat is being put in. So I really see this as being something that's done. As Marla said, you know, how great of a solution is this to put a bunch of flowers out on the landscape? So there's a lot of government funding now in the Farm Bill to put on private lands pollinator habitat. And there's a lot of growers in Minnesota, corn growers and soy growers that are actually really interested in doing this sort of work. So there's a lot of private groups that are interested in this. So I think this idea of getting habitat on the landscape is really happening, and that's a goal I think that can be achieved. The big questions, though, in my mind now is to figure out how to do it well. So what plants do we need to put in? How do we benefit bees that are declining? How do we benefit honeybees and monarchs? So how do we implement these habitat plantings in a way that's really going to have a positive effect? Where do we put these habitat plantings in? These are questions that are still not answered really well. So we can get to a certain quantity, I think, pretty well, but how to do it well is still a bit of a mystery that we're working on.
We're inviting your questions as we talk to three scientists from the U who are studying this pollinator health. That was Dan Carrivo, you just heard there, Karen Oberhauser here as well, and Marla Spivak. And we're taking your questions, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Our first call here, I think, is going to suggest that it's not just as easy as planting flowers. Ona is in Lanesboro. Good morning. Your question.
Thanks so much. I've been dismayed to watch milkweed dying back in my neighborhood in the wake of a 2,4-D spraying, and it was conducted by my municipality. I'd like to know how I can help a small city and towns everywhere to develop good policy and practice within their own communities.
Karen?
Well, thanks for that question, Ona. That's a great question. And I think the fact that you live in a small town and a community, you probably know some of the people that are in charge of making these decisions. So, you know, we just need to get out. And when we see people carrying out practices that don't make good conservation sense, we just need to talk to them and try to change these behaviors.
Is this just a spray? What is this?
Yeah,
an herbicide?
So she mentioned 2,4-D, which is an herbicide that acts on broadleaf plants. It doesn't kill grasses.
Is this something people are doing just in their yards, or is this a city thing?
It can be the city in some cases, or individual people can use it in their yards. It's often used as a lawn herbicide because people like just grass in their yards. But you know, it's complicated because, especially in the ditches where milkweed grows, we have issues with invasive plants. For example, wild parsnip is moving through a lot of ditches in our state, and once that moves into a ditch, it's going to outcompete the milkweed. So we need integrated, wise pest management. We need that milkweed in the ditches and wherever it was in your municipality, but we also need to make sure that we're managing that habitat and keeping out the invasive plants that could, you know, just wipe everything out. So
does that, Karen, mean that as we think about a complex problem and the complex answers, that the answer is not necessarily nowhere besides know how never? Or is that the answer, is to completely eliminate them?
Well, that's a great question. It's much easier to manage habitat if herbicides are applied judiciously. But there are a lot of really great restorations that go in, a lot of great management practices that might take a little more work and don't use herbicides. So there are very smart and well-meaning people on both sides of this herbicide debate, and neither one has the monopoly on the truth, but it takes wise management. So I think getting out and talking to the people in charge and saying, hey, there's milkweed there, monarchs use that, that's the only food plant, can we avoid killing it, especially right now when there are so many monarch, or not this year. Mm-hmm. This is when we should be seeing a lot of monarchs, eggs, and caterpillars. We aren't so much this year, but it needs to be there. But we also need to manage the habitat, and sometimes the easiest way to do that is to use some herbicides.
Marla, what would you add?
Just briefly, I put some pollinator habitat in my front yard in St. Paul, which was not received very well the first year. But when I put
by the neighbors, you mean?
Well, by the city. But I put up a sign that says pollinator habitat. So maybe for this caller, if she puts up a sign that said this is monarch habitat or pollinator habitat, the neighbors may understand that this is a project. This is something that we're doing for the environment.
When the city was upset about that, did you remind them that you're a genius?
No.
Did you throw the MacArthur grant? Or did you throw it at them?
No.
But what about that? I mean, again, that goes to what the caller was saying, and we don't need to necessarily pick on any one municipality, but you know, there are expectations for how our lawns look. There are expectations for how a city drive or a city boulevard looks. And it sounds like that can be in conflict with what you see as best practices for saving these little guys and gals.
Right. So there's many ways to put in pollinator habitat that would be palatable, that would not be go against. They don't have to look as weedy as my front yard, for example, and as jungle-like and wild. One of the things that we're researching are these flowering lawns, bee lawns. So how can you have turf and how can you incorporate some native flowers that you could mow and manicure that would flower and provide food for bees? And you probably would not want to use herbicide on that because you would kill the flowers. You probably would not want to mow it as much because then it would take down the flowers. So it's just kind of a low input and beautiful lawn. And there's other ways that would benefit native bees also.
Let's take a call here. Mina is in St. Charles. Good morning. Go right ahead.
Good morning. I'm from St. Charles, and we farm, and we also own a solar company. And a couple of the things that you guys were talking about, we do have a lot of our solar gardens are in rural Minnesota that are in the farming communities, and we have a lot of our landowners that do want to put these pollinator mixes under the gardens, but one of the things with milkweed for the monarch, that milkweed, if it gets into the fields, it takes over. So they want to mix without milkweed, but we also want something for the monarchs. So that's a question that we have. What can we do there? And we also are following, I think, one of the women speaking so that she put a sign up in her garden to let people know that this is a pollinator mix. And that's one thing that we're going to be doing, too, so people understand when it's not at its prime, you know, with all the flowers blooming, that this is for the pollinators. But my question is on the milkweed and how we can get something for the monarchs.
Thanks so much, Karen.
So monarchs only eat milkweed. The caterpillars, there's nothing else you can do. But I think the concern about milkweed in fields needs a little more education. The milkweed that used to be is no longer, but used to be a problem in fields is common milkweed. There are over 100 species of milkweed in North America. Common milkweed is the one that you see more commonly. And it used to be a problem, but now the vast majority of the corn and soybean fields around you are herbicide tolerant. The farmers are spraying those fields, so milkweed won't move into the fields just because the fields are being sprayed and keeping milkweed and other weeds out. I would recommend in under these solar gardens, and Marla and I are both really excited about that possibility. It's such a win-win situation, is choosing a lower growing species of milkweed. For instance, butterfly milkweed, Asclepias tuberosa, is lower growing. It won't impair the solar panels themselves, and it's easier to manage. There's another species called whorled milkweed, or Asclepias verticillata, that would be a great one to put under these panels. So, and neither of these are aggressive species that would cause a problem moving into fields. Swamp milkweed. So there are a lot of other choices between common milkweed, which I will admit my front yard looks a lot like Marla's, and common milkweed is a little bit aggressive. But yeah, it would probably not be the choice because it's too tall.
Oh, we're taking your questions here this hour as we are jumping off. Last week, the White House releasing this final version of this plan to improve pollinator health. There was the report earlier this year from this UN-affiliated group talking about the danger and the crisis, frankly, that still exists. And we have a lot of research going on here in Minnesota at the University of Minnesota and elsewhere about bees and butterflies and pollinators. So we brought in three of these experts here to take your questions and talk about this. 1-800-242-2828. More of your questions and conversation after a check of this hour's news with Stephen John. Hi, Stephen.
Morning, Tom. The U.S. Supreme Court's ruling striking down regulations for Texas abortion clinics could mean the end of similar laws in other states, including Wisconsin. Today's 5-3 vote struck down rules that required doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals and forced clinics to meet hospital-like standards for outpatient surgery. A similar law Wisconsin Republicans passed in 2013 regarding admitting privileges was later struck down by a court of appeals. Stocks are moving lower on Wall Street following bigger losses in Europe as investors continued to grapple with the Brexit fallout. The British pound continued to fall as traders expected the British economy would take a hit. The Dow was down about 250 points in midday trading. A new study says Donald Trump's tax and budget plans would make the national debt skyrocket by $10 trillion or more over the coming decade, mostly because of expensive tax cuts. Hillary Clinton's plan would also add to the debt, but by only a fraction as much. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget says Clinton's agenda, which relies on tax increases to pay for proposals such as expanding the Affordable Care Act, would increase the debt by about $250 million over 10 years. Two men who were presumed dead when a camper was swept away in rushing waters during the West Virginia floods have been found alive. Officials said the discovery of the men lowers the death toll to 23. Mostly sunny, 68 degrees in the Twin Cities. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
On Morning Edition, Kathy Werzer asks the questions that need to be answered.
Which companies here do you think will be hardest hit by the vote?
I don't think that companies in the United States are going to be hard hit.
Tune in weekdays from 4 to 9 on Minnesota Public Radio News.
Coming up on NPR News, you'll hear the first broadcast from this year's Aspen Ideas Festival, which is underway. The early part of the festival is focused on health. Tune in at noon. If you missed Chris Farrell's thoughts this hour on how Minnesota businesses might be affected by Brexit, or our show Friday about identity, which included a conversation with reporter Dwale Saikautau about the Hmong American experience, you can find those and other interviews from the 11 o'clock hour on our podcast. Search for NPR News with Tom Weber, or go to nprnews.org/podcasts. Oh, and be sure to tune in Friday when we begin our summer music series. Each Friday in July and August, another Minnesota musician and great conversation. This Friday, we'll have fiddler Galen Lee of Duluth.
Support for this program comes from the Women's Foundation of Minnesota, driving gender equity for women and girls through grant-making, research, and policy, providing leadership to end sex trafficking in Minnesota. WFMN.org.
Programming supported by Thomson Reuters eDiscovery Point, a new web-based eDiscovery software solution that delivers speed, accuracy, and ease of use. Thomson Reuters provides the intelligence, technology, and human expertise to find trusted answers. Thomson Reuters, the answer company.
Continuing our conversation with our pollinator experts here from the University of Minnesota this hour here on NPR News. Let's go back to phone calls, I should say. Here, Meredith. Let's do Meredith on line one in Peterson. Hi, Meredith. Your question.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Hi. Well, I'm a teacher, and I'm just wondering how I can or what resources I can access to either give to my students to take home or teach in class. We have space for gardens. I also live in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just kind of looking for a place to start.
Dan, do you have
someone would know that.
Do you have any thoughts for Meredith there?
Well, I think, you know, if you have a spot for a garden, that's fantastic. So we, on our website, on the Bee Lab website, we have a bunch of plants that are fantastic for bees, and they'll also attract monarchs and wonderful butterflies. And I would recommend putting that in to any sort of garden, and you'll get a great thing. One of the fun things about pollinators and why I love working with them is that a lot of the work I do is just going out to flowers and simply watching. And when you do that, you see amazing diversity. You see honeybees. You see all these fantastic native bees. You see really beautiful butterflies and interesting flies and odd beetles and all sorts of things. So if you can plant a really nice garden with lots of blooming flowers, you're just going to get a ton of interesting stuff for the kids to go out and check out. And I think that's simply the best thing that you could do.
Tell me about I forget what it's called, the bee building. I think it's opening here pretty soon on the is it the Twin Cities campus in St.
Yeah,
Paul?
Yeah, in the St. Paul campus, and that'll be opening sometime in late summer. We'll be actually moving in, and Marla and I are really excited to kind of get going on that one.
What is it, Marla, and how will that change the research you've been doing, and what will that open up for figuring out what we're figuring out?
It's a new bee research laboratory that was funded by the state. 2/3 of the funding came from the state of Minnesota, which thank you so much. And mostly it will just allow us to do our research more efficiently. Right now we're spread over the St. Paul campus. Dan doesn't even really have a lab since he's been here, so finally he'll have a lab. And my ultimate goal would be to find some space for Karen and Monarchs to be in the same lab so that we could all be together if possible. But it's a wonderful facility, and it's right on St. Paul campus. There's another one opening also at the Landscape Arboretum, part of the university, over in Chaska,
mm-hmm.
and that's for the public. And so they will have exhibits and displays and educational material about landscaping and the landscaping itself for everybody to go out and learn about native bees and honeybees and monarchs.
So they do, at the Arboretum, they do those showcase gardens that you can learn from and go home and do at your garden, and it'll never look as good as they do at the Arboretum, right?
Exactly.
You can do the same for making a pollinator-friendly garden.
Exactly.
So that it doesn't look like Marla's jumble of weeds.
Exactly. Yes, you
have
it.
I got it all. Karen?
Yeah, I'd just like to say something to Meredith. It's so great that you want to bring this information to your students. And just wanted to point out that we have a bunch of classes at the university for teachers that go on in the summertime. In fact, I had to leave my class to come here today, but we have a group of teachers who are working on pollinators. This session or this group is being led by one of Marla's PhD candidates, Elaine Evans. So we have a lot of resources. You'd be welcome to contact me. A lot of great lessons to do once you get your pollinator garden in that Dan was describing. Ways that you can teach your students about different species of bees and how to observe them and looking at the flowers. So there's a lot of great stuff to do, and thank you for your interest in that.
I read an article, it actually was from last year, so I don't know where this stands, Karen, but it actually talked about how some efforts by backyard gardeners, right? All this army of regular Joes and Janes who need to help plant the right plants are potentially hurting especially the monarch butterfly plight if they're planting the wrong kind of milkweed. And the issue here that I read in this one article had to do with the milkweed that the migratory monarchs need. Those plants actually fall apart in the fall, as they should, but these other milkweed plants don't, and so it makes them sedentary. Is that still an issue? Is that something we need to be mindful of when we think about milkweed?
Well, We don't really need to worry about that in Minnesota because the species of milkweed that is at issue here is a tropical milkweed called Asclepias curassavica. Here it dies back. It's an annual plant. It's actually a really pretty milkweed. It's great to have native plants and would always be preferred, but it wouldn't cause problems here. Where the concern is in the south, where this plant is is around for longer periods of time and could affect the monarch's migratory behavior.
So in general, with milkweed, just go for it is what you're saying.
Just go for it up here. You're not gonna cause problems. And like I said before, there are so many cool kinds of milkweeds to plant.
All right. Kate in Shorewood has a question. Good morning, Kate. Go right ahead.
Thank you. As a home gardener, I'm aware of problems with neonicotinoids in plants. But I'm also wondering about things like deer repellents. The deer repellents that you spray that smell foul. And then I recently noticed that there are some deer repellents that can be added to the soil that can be taken up through the entire plant. Are those a problem for pollinators, bees, and or butterflies?
Any thoughts here? Does anyone know?
I don't think they would be a problem. I don't know for certain, but bees are pretty good at smelling flowers, and they're going to understand the difference between a deer repellent and the floral odor. So I think not.
Okay. Question online here. David wondered about a pest called an assassin wasp that's hurting bees. Do you know about that? Is that a thing, Dan?
Well, there's an assassin wasp. There are some wasps that actually attack bees. They're called bee wolves. They're really fascinating, interesting predators. Those are not having any sort of negative impact. It's not something that we worry about as, you know, to me, that's just really kind of cool stuff on the Serengeti here in Minnesota.
Okay, but the concept of a bee wolf, how have we not made a movie about a bee?
Oh, we could have
wolf?
A long discussion about all the cool stuff in entomology. But yeah, that they're fascinating creatures.
What do you see going on? Before we go on to looking ahead here, also, where we've talked about the complexity of why this is happening to these bees. What effect do we know about climate change is contributing to that? And I'll throw that out to anyone. Dan?
There's been a number of different studies showing some effects of climate change. We still don't know. We still are really collecting a lot of data on that. There's been some evidence of some bees migrating up from, well, moving their ranges up from the south up into the north. There's one study that seemed to demonstrate that some bees are being displaced more northern, but they're also, the more northern bees are having nowhere to go. So they're not able to expand their ranges. So the data on that are still really kind of out. So we're waiting to see what's happening there.
Thoughts on butterflies, Karen?
Sure. Butterflies have been one of the big groups of species that have been studied quite well with respect to climate change. And what we know about butterflies is that there will be winners and losers. Some species are being pushed up and up and up mountaintops where they won't be able to go any further. Some are being pushed into ranges that might be climatically appropriate, but where their host plants aren't available. So like anything else, we as humans are conducting this great big experiment with nature with a sample size of one. That's not a good experiment. You'd like to have a control where you're not changing things, but we'll find out how the species that we care about will respond. And it doesn't look great.
You know, on the bee side, Marla, that having the hive in the backyard as a hobby is a thing. And in fact, in recent years, we've seen more cities changing their laws or updating the laws. So you can have a beehive. And I'm sure you could comment on whether those are even as far along as they should be, in your opinion. But is the beehive, is the beekeeping, I don't know if it was a fad, I don't know what to call it, but is it still as robust as it was, at least when it was in that spotlight there in the last couple of years?
It still is in the spotlight. There are so many people now that want to become backyard beekeepers. It's a good thing, and it has its problems also. If we get too many bees in the landscape, there might not be enough flowers. There's also the risk of disease transmission and that parasite that I talked about, that mite. When we get a lot of bees in backyards, we have to be really, really careful about managing that parasite so that it doesn't devastate all the colonies within the city. Mostly, I think the beehive in people's backyards is a good opening for people to understand what we need in the landscape and how to reduce our pesticide use or use pesticides more judiciously, as Karen said, so that we don't, so that we can do pest control, but that we can protect our beneficial insects. That's what I think the beehives in the backyards are helping people understand.
Is there a rule of thumb? If your neighbor has it, maybe you don't need it, that kind of a thing?
Honeybees fly 2 miles, so they're covering an 8,000-acre area. So, yeah, if your neighbors have a colony of bees, you really don't need them unless you just can't help yourself. You have to have a beehive, too.
Okay, here's a question or a comment here from Pat in Duluth. Hi, Pat. Go right ahead.
Hi. Hi. I wanted to say that I did a bee class with Elaine Evans up in Grand Marais, and I thought that was a really neat way for, you know, people who have cameras especially to take images of these bumblebees and submit them to the Bee Atlas or to Bumblebee Watch to get an idea of which species are present. And then on Wednesday, we were down in the cities and went to a little cafe, Birchwood, and they had bee plants with a yellow sign on the boulevard. And I was just astonished. They had milkweed beetles. They had metallic green bees, hoverflies, honeybees, all in, like, you know, a two little section of the boulevard. And it was, I mean, I was in seventh heaven. And then finally, for, like, beginning and advanced gardeners, a great resource is your local native plant nursery, because typically, and you have to be sure, but they don't use neonics or chemicals. And normally, they're growing from seed plants that are within, like, a 50-mile radius of where the person lives. And if they put in the right plant in the right spot, natives, once they're established, are so easy to handle. And like Marla, our yard is a jungle. But, I mean, I'm astonished when I go out there and I'm photographing these insects, and I can't believe sometimes what I find right in our own backyard. And so that's all I had to say, and I wanted to thank all of you for your help with bees and other pollinators. A million thanks.
All right. Thanks so much for the shout-out there. Dan, were you going to add something?
Yeah, no, that's just great. I love hearing that. For me, I still have that sense of discovery where you go, and as Pat mentioned, where you go and you look at a plot of flowers, and it's just all this cacophony of life that's sitting out there. And what's wonderful is that, you know, for much of my life, I didn't notice that. I would walk past that all the time. But once I was turned on to that, once somebody showed me what that was, it was this hidden gem that I had been walking past. You know, you walk past these gardens every day, and it's not until you finally look at them, and it's just amazing. And you just, it's people are annoyed to go hiking with me now. I don't really get very far in my hikes.
You do
it's a problem.
A tenth of a mile
so
hike.
So that's an issue. But besides that, it's just, it's fantastic to open up that world.
So if you can't stop to smell the roses, stop to watch the bees.
Yeah,
is that
exactly.
What you're saying?
Yeah, totally.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the conversation here. And clearly, as it's still an issue, we'll have to have you all back as this progresses and your research continues and the bee building opens and all of that fun stuff. So thanks so much for being here, Dan Caravo from the Department of Entomology.
Thank you.
And Marla Spivak, also from the Department of Entomology.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And Karen Oberhauser from Fisheries, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
More online at nprnews.org.